outside?
This will be okay, and I'm not 100% sure if I'll end up using it, so I'm sorry. It may or may not. I don't know yet. There were handouts. There were two handouts. Is there anyone that doesn't have both of the handouts? Raise your hand, and they'll make sure you get your copy. We're going to use those, and so I want to make sure you have them. And maybe while they're doing that, I'll just open it up. Are there any questions or comments from what we've looked at so far? Friday night and Saturday night, we looked at the story of the Bible, and then we also focused mostly on the Old Testament. So is there any comment, any question from what we've had so far while they're handing out these copies? Well, as they continue to do that, I'll just talk a little bit about what I'm planning for this morning. In the first session, I want to talk just a little bit about the New Testament. Not a whole lot, because the second session is going to be focused on what the New Testament tells us about non-resistance. But I'm going to look a little bit at the New Testament, and then I'm going to look at church history. And church history is one of my profoundest loves. It just helps us understand so much as we see why we are where we are, what has happened to bring us to this place can really be helpful. And so that's what I'm going to spend most of the time on in this first session. And then the second session will be more doctrinal, more what does the New Testament have to say about our approach to life in general. Okay, I think we're just about done with passing those out. we're going to look at the New Testament just a little bit this first session, but then we're going to look more at the history of the church, which you've probably heard somebody already say this is Acts chapter 29. We're the continuation of what God's started in the just after the time of Jesus being here on the earth with the foundation of the church. And we then have the early history of the church in the 28 chapters of Acts. And we are hopefully the continuation of that. This is all, as was said, God's story working with his people. So what I'd like to mention is two little parts of the New Testament. One is the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm not really going to read anything about that. I'm not going to read a part of it right now. But I just want to talk about how this impacted the people of Jesus' day when he gave this sermon. And one of the key factors of this sermon is he says, "You have heard it said," and usually he quoted an Old Testament passage, "but I say to you." And the interesting thing is the Jews knew that they probably needed some correction about how they worshiped God after they built the second temple. They were aware that probably they had missed some things that were practiced and done in the first period of the first temple period. And so one of the things they expected the Messiah to do was to come and correct and bring them to their knowledge of how to worship God to perfection. Jews today that are waiting for the Messiah, they still feel the same way. They expect the Messiah is going to come and tell them the things that they have somehow lost. And so this is how they were feeling in the time of Jesus. We're not sure that we understand completely. We're not sure we're doing the temple worship completely correctly. And they were looking forward to someone to come to do this. The very fact that Jesus got up and said, "You've heard this, but I tell you, this is the way the Father really wants it." This is his heart. He, in what he gave us in the Old Testament, Sometimes it's its heart, and sometimes it's more the things that need to be to help us to mature so that we can finally hear his heart. So when Jesus got up and did this, even without saying, I'm the Messiah, this made everybody wonder, who is he? Is he the Messiah? Is he the one that's going to tell us the full reality of what God expects of us? And so that was extremely important in how it affected the Jewish people. It opened them up to the possibility that he was the Messiah. And it also can be looked at as the constitution for the church. This is how God wants his people to live. And that's usually how Christians looked at it, especially in the early days of the church. One more thing I want to look, so that's just a little bit of background. One more thing I want to look at before we get into the history of the church is 2 Corinthians 10. And you can turn to that, 2 Corinthians 10. And what I want us to notice here is that non-resistance, it can have a passive expression, but that's not the way it's usually to be expressed. So it's not essentially passive. And I think the thing that I want us to notice here most importantly is that that it starts with us. It starts with us in our hearts. So Paul, I'm going to read the first five verses in 2 Corinthians 10. I, Paul, myself, entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I, who am humble when face to face with you, but bold towards you when I am away. I beg you that when I am present, I may not have to show boldness with such confidence as I count on showing against some who suspect us of walking according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ, being ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is complete. And what I notice here, he makes it very clear. Our warfare, we have a struggle. You know, the fact that we are non-resistant doesn't mean that there's not a war that we're involved in. It doesn't mean we don't have a struggle or a battle. We do have a struggle and a battle. But the place that it starts is in the Christian's heart. So Paul is talking to his people and calling them to recognize that they it's not physical weapons that we're going to use, but we do need to defeat strongholds of Satan if those are in us. So the first act of non-resistance is to actually sense, are there problems in our own lives? Are there places that are there strongholds where I don't let God tell me what to do? I don't hear him, where I say, you know, I'm going to do it my way. And Paul is saying that these have to be rooted out. And as I say, he's talking specifically to his people, to the church. So the first place that we need to deal with is our own hearts. And one more place I want to look before we get into the history, and that is Romans 12. This is a passage that it fits with what we read in 2 Corinthians 10, and it's one that we've heard a lot. Romans 12, the first two verses. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercy of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and what is acceptable and what is perfect. So we have to recognize there may be strongholds in our own lives, and we have to, first of all, deal with that. Paul talks about being renewed, transformed by the renewal of your minds. Just because you've given yourself to God, Just because you become a Christian doesn't mean there aren't things in you that need to be changed. That's my experience. I'm not pointing fingers at you. I'm saying, though, that all of us, we need to be open to God's working in our lives so that we can actually show the world what the gospel is all about. We're his hands and we're his feet in this world, and we've got to be prepared. Doesn't mean we have to be perfect, but we have to be prepared. And even in the stumbling that we do, if we handle that correctly, if we go to whoever we've offended and apologize and say, you know, I was wrong there, that's part of the gospel too. That's part of doing what God wants of us. So he's not expecting us to be perfect, but he is expecting us to be the people through whom the gospel shines out into the world. Okay, let's talk a little bit about church history, what comes after the New Testament. In the early church, the first conflict was, and I forget if I have this, let me see here. Yeah, early church. The first conflict is the disagreement or the question, who is Lord? And Paul makes it clear that this is an essential aspect, that you have to recognize Jesus is Lord. Well, guess what? Political units, states, empires, they actually always try to use religion. They incorporate religion into convincing people that they are what they should be. And even when you have a communist system, okay, I admit that they oppose religion, but they kind of generate their own religion. All you need to do is look into the history of the Soviet Union. Lenin founded the Soviet Union. And where is Lenin now? Anybody know? Huh? Actually, he isn't. Does anybody know where he is? He's in a shrine. That sounds pretty religious to me. He is a symbol of what communism is about. And in fact, you could see signs in the Soviet days. Lenin is alive. So that is very. And by the way, the same thing is in China. Mao is also in a shrine, and he is lifted up. And the present leader of China is lifted up basically as a religious leader, a religious founder. So I know they deny religion, but there's something in every human being that wants to worship. And even in a very, very atheistic system like communism, people worship the founders of communism and the ideals of communism. So the state always uses religion to its purpose, to get people behind it. The Roman state did the same thing. They expected everyone to be willing to offer a little bit of incense at an idol, statue of the emperor, and to say Caesar is Lord. So they'd burn a little bit of incense and say Caesar is Lord. The Roman state felt this would unite the people and also would please the gods. And so this was definitely a part of the Roman state system. The Christians said, you know, you can be saved if you believe, if you say that Jesus is Lord and you believe in your heart that he was raised from the dead. If you believe that, and if you can say that, you've turned around and started to follow Jesus. So there was actually this huge conflict between the Roman state and the Christians. The Christians could not say Caesar is Lord. And so when they were required to do this, they rejected it. And many of them went to their death because of this. Some of them were, they were usually brought into the Colosseum and fed to the animals, or gladiators would kill them. Things like that would happen. So there was... right from the beginning, there was a conflict because the Roman state was trying to deify itself It was okay with you worshiping the other gods, but you had to worship Caesar as a representative of the state, and the Christians couldn't do that. So right from the beginning, there was conflict between the state and the church. We have a lot of writings from the early days, the first 300 years of the church. There were a lot more that were written, but that we haven't been able to preserve. But the ones that we have are very interesting. Because of this conflict between the church and the state, this idea got written about a lot. What is the responsibility of a Christian? And it was clear the Christian is supposed to pray for this emperor. He's supposed to honor the emperor. These are all things that are in the scriptures, and so they simply would restate those. But it was also clear in their mind that God, the Christian could not say that Caesar is Lord or offer a little bit of incense. It didn't make sense to the Romans because most people believed in many gods and they could worship more than one god. Why can't these Christians worship Jesus but also worship Caesar? They couldn't understand that. All of the writings we have in those first 300 years consistently uphold the idea that Christians cannot be part of the government. Why? The government defended the borders, and the government also judged cases that were capital cases where someone might be executed. And the Christians consistently said, this is not something we can do. So the Christians avoided both the participation in the government and participation in the military. Now, over time, something happened that the church had to make a decision about. The earliest we know about this is probably the late 100s. In the Roman Empire, if you wanted to be in the army, you signed up for one, one tour of duty. In the United States, it's something like three or four years, and then you can sign up again, and you can sign up again. Well, in the Roman Empire, it was, I think it was 25 years. So you signed up once, and if you survived, then the government gave you land, a place to settle, and this is one of the ways that the Latin language expanded throughout Europe because of settling soldiers after they retired in all these different areas. So that's where the languages that are related to Latin come from: French, Spanish, Portuguese, Romanian, and Italian. But anyway, so you signed up for one tour, and if you survived, you were retired, and you were given a farm to live on and take care of your family. Now, what happens? What do you think? Over time, there are going to be men in the military. They've signed up. They were pagans. They signed up. And somewhere along the line, they're going to hear the gospel. What do you think might happen in that situation? You're in the military. Oh, by the way, you can't get out. You're in there for one tour, and if you don't die in battle, you are in for the 25 years. So what might happen as these soldiers, they perhaps move around throughout the empire, they meet different people, they talk to the locals. Somewhere along the line, some of them are going to hear the gospel. What do you think is going to happen? Say again? I didn't hear it. Oh yeah, they're going to believe. Some of them are going to believe. You can't get out of the military. And the church started to find out that there were people who are in the military that are believing and they want to be part of the church. And so the church had to decide what to do about that. And what happened is that the church decided that it will allow soldiers who are already in the service and can't get out, but who have given their lives to Jesus, it will baptize them and allow them to be part of the church if they promise that they will not kill anyone. And the Roman army was the strongest army in the world at that time because their discipline was extremely strict. And if your commanding officer said, do something, and you didn't do it, you would either be immediately, he would either tell one of the soldiers to kill him right away or take him into custody and then kill him later in a very painful way in front of all of his comrades to show this is what happens when you disobey. So disobedience was not a very common thing in the Roman army. But the church was it kind of had a paradox. Here are people who really believe in Jesus. They can't get out of the military. So what are we going to do? We will let them. By the way, they had an instruction class at this time, and it lasted often a couple of years. So they said, we will let these soldiers be in the instruction class and be baptized after the instruction class if they make this promise. And this promise means that they are willing to give their life up if the commander ever says, kill someone or go into battle. Now, you can easily imagine something like this could cause a problem. What if we have this instruction class, and most of the people in the instruction class are either children from the present-day Christians, or maybe they're pagans who want to become part of the church. This could cause a problem if there's a soldier in the instruction class because the church is trying to tell its own people, no, we don't go to war, we don't participate in the government, and yet here's this man who is in the military and we're bringing him into the church. I think it was a good move, a necessary compromise, if you want to call it a compromise, but it did cause problems. And in the writings that we have, it's very interesting. It's made clear that the soldier has to be willing to give his life up if he's commanded to kill someone. And then he can come into the church. But it's also fascinating that it also says if there's some young guys in the instruction class who decide, well, if he can be a soldier, I can be a soldier too. Let's face it, there's something alluring to a young man about the military and defending his country, etc. There is for a lot of young men. And so some of those young men are going to say, well, if he can be in the military, why can't I? The writings about this whole situation make it very clear that if there is someone in instruction class or even a baptized Christian who seeks to become a soldier, he must be excluded. He cannot be part of the church. So they faced a really difficult issue for a time period, how to bring people in that couldn't get out of the military, but also make sure that their own people didn't see that as an option now. So that was one of the very early struggles that church had. Oh, and one more thing about that. It's the average guy, you know, the average Joe, like all of us here, who joined the military for 25 years. The upper class could join the military for a time, and that way they could lead a unit, a military unit, and that could help them politically. So they could join for a while, the upper class could join the military for a while, and then come out. The upper class could participate in government, and they could also withdraw whenever they wanted to. The same set of writings that we have about what to do with a soldier who becomes a Christian and how others in the instruction class may not become a soldier, we also have in that same writing that the upper class people, because they can withdraw from the military and they can withdraw from the government on their own freely whenever they choose, they must withdraw if they want to be in the instruction class and eventually be baptized. So I think it's really very clear that the church, let's say around the year 200, is working with a situation that isn't exactly shown in the scripture, but it's a new situation. They have to figure out what to do. And I think they made a good decision, allowing soldiers in if they promise they will not kill. And there are some wonderful stories. In the Martyr's Mirror, there is a story about some soldiers who capture a group of Christians. I haven't read it recently. There's a certain number of Christians they capture. I think it was in Switzerland, and I think it was during the winter, and they stripped the clothes off the Christians and tied them up and put them on the frozen lakes to die. And there was one soldier who had already heard the gospel and he wanted to be a Christian. At this point, I don't think he had contacted anyone, but one of the Christians surrendered his faith and survived. He wasn't killed. And that soldier, the way the story is told, he made up the number by taking the place of the man who said, I apostatize. I don't believe in Jesus anymore. So he saved his life. This soldier hadn't actually become a Christian yet. I don't think he was in instruction class, but he knew the gospel and he believed it. And so he would not do what the other soldiers were doing and kill these men. And he himself then took the place of this one Christian who gave up his faith and saved his life that way, at least his physical life. So there's just interesting stories. Now, in the 200s, the Roman state starts to persecute the church in a very organized way, and a way of, all the way across the empire, the Christian church was persecuted. And it wreaked great havoc on the church, because everywhere Christians were put into very hard situations. You couldn't buy or sell without a certificate that you had worshipped Caesar, that you had burned incense for Caesar. And some Christians had friends who were in the government, and they got false certificates so that they could survive. This was very hard on the church. Some people lapsed or fell away, or at least partly fell away, and it caused the church great trouble. The reason the state persecuted the Christians this way was because they felt that the Christians were destroying the good virtues that made for manly Romans who are going to defeat the world. That was one aspect. The other aspect was these Christians won't worship Caesar or the other gods, and so the gods are angry at us. And so that's why there were these intense persecutions. There were three very intense persecutions, two of them in the middle and latter part of the 200s, and then the last persecution, which was the worst, was in the from about 303 to 325, or 24, I should say, and caused a lot of havoc in the church. Now, after that last persecution was ended by somebody named Constantine. He took over the western part of the empire, and he stopped the persecution there. And then eventually he took over the eastern part of the empire. In other words, he ruled the whole empire. He took it away from the pagan emperors, and he ended the persecution, which was a good thing. But he also started to treat the church in a special way. And if you would, look at the handout that says the gradual shift from 292 to 529. How would you feel? Put yourself in that last persecution. It was the most severe persecution that the Christians ever faced. It persecuted not only the clergy, but it also persecuted the individual Christian. And everyone's life was forfeit if they were found to be Christian. Then Constantine comes along, and he defeats the pagan emperor. And so now all of a sudden, persecution ended. How would you feel? Relieved? Anybody have any other responses? Surprised? And there were some suspicious ones, but most weren't. Anybody else have an idea?
It's an answer to prayer.
There's a historical description of this by a man named Eusebius, and he says that God raised up Constantine and his son to destroy the pagan emperor who was wrecking his church. And he says that before the pagan emperor was defeated, the Christians would walk around with their eyes turned down because, you know, I don't want you to look at me and say, are you a Christian? So they were very scared. And when they were out in public, they were very careful. And then he says, Constantine and his son defeated Licinius, the pagan emperor. And then he says it was all light and joy. People were dancing and celebrating and looking at each other in the faces and praising God because he had saved them. And indeed, in a way, he had. But this is the beginning of the church and the state starting to come together, starting to work together. And it's a very unfortunate thing that happened. The early church, as I was trying to make clear, consistently said Christians are in another kingdom. We don't take part in government or in the military. Now let's look at this gradual shift. Diocletian was the emperor who started that last and worst persecution. And before he started the persecution, he expelled any Christians that were in the army. And remember, there were some Christians in the army because the church was trying to work with people who, after they joined the military, became Christians. And so there were some Christians in the military. Diocletian expelled them in 292, probably had two reasons. One was he was thinking about the persecution and he didn't want people in the military who wouldn't agree with the persecution of the Christians. It's probably one. And the other thing is, and I think this is maybe the most important, he believed in the gods. And he thought that it was an offense to the gods that these Christians were in the army. He was afraid the gods would not give victory to his army if it was a mixed situation, if there were pagans and Christians in it. Okay. A little bit later, he starts the persecution, and eventually Constantine ends it. And when Constantine ends the persecution, he starts to favor the church. At first, the church was simply freed from persecution. But over time, more and more things were done to favor the church. So after the persecution ended, there was a council called the Council of Nicaea, which was an important council and I think came up with some good ideas. Don't have enough time to talk about what those were. But Constantine provided his palace and he provided the postal service to bring all the bishops over the empire together at his palace. And he fed them. He took care of all their expenses. Now, what would you think about this? There were some people who were suspicious. There were. But probably most of the people said, we've already decided God has used Constantine to end the persecution, to make us free. And so most of the bishops, some of them were suspicious, and maybe some were a little suspicious, but most of them went to Nicaea to talk about how to think about Jesus as human and divine, and also the Trinity. Those were the big questions. Some people would say the church fell at this point. I wouldn't say that. I want us to remember, they had never had the ruler of a country or the empire treat them well. And so now, all of a sudden, they're being treated well, and it feels like God at work. And there is a sense in which God was at work, but where it goes is not good. The church, from that point on, gradually starts to work more and more closely with the empire, with the government. And big changes happen. And I think it's understandable why this happened. They had no history of what happens when the church and the state kind of draw together. Remember what I said earlier, all states use religion to undergird themselves, to get people to support them. I don't know that it's conscious, but that's what happens. And I think that's what Constantine and the followers after him, the following emperors after Constantine, were doing, even if it was subconscious. Anyway, gradually the church and state come closer and closer together until in the 380s and 90s, Theodosius I and II, they make Christianity the state religion. Now, they don't make it illegal to be a pagan. They close all the pagan temples down, and they make pagan worship illegal, but they don't persecute the pagans, at least not at first, and they don't persecute the Jews. So the state religion is Christianity, and people are encouraged to become Christians, but there are still pagans and Jews in the empire. But we've also, I have on the paper, there are various things that the emperors did. The emperors had been called Pontifex Maximus, and that was a pagan religious term to say that the emperor was the highest priest among the pagans, and Pontifex Maximus means he builds bridges between man and the gods. And the emperor continued using that title even after they were baptized as Christians. But eventually, that's dropped in, do I have it written down here? Yes, Gratian was one of these emperors in the 380s, and he dropped that title from his list of titles. He's no longer the bridge builder between the gods and man. They closed the Olympics because the Olympics were a pagan religious event. I know it was athletics, but it was dedicated to the pagan gods. So the Christian emperors are now starting to not exactly persecute paganism, but they're putting big restrictions on it. And then, like I say, they made Christianity the state religion. Then look at the second line, down here at 416. In 416, Theodosius II expels the non-Christians, the pagans, from the army. Why did he do that? Exactly. Diocletian expelled Christians because he didn't want anybody that he might not be able to trust. But the biggest reason is the gods were not pleased with these people that don't worship God. They weren't pleased with them in the army. Theodosius expels the pagans for exactly the same reason. He wants to make sure everybody's behind him, so they should be Christians. But the biggest reason is the God of the Christians won't be happy if the army has pagans in it. Do you see the shift that's happening? It's very gradual, and I think we have to try to recognize that this kind of stuff hadn't happened yet. And so the Christians are trying to feel their way through, and unfortunately, they're coming closer and closer to uniting the church and the state. It is interesting, for years after Christianity was the official religion of the empire, the upper class people who are Christians wouldn't get baptized right away. They would serve either in the military or in the government because they felt that was necessary to maintain the empire, which was maintaining order in the world. Then, after a period of time in the military or in the government, they would withdraw. They would go to instruction class, and they would be baptized. And then they would not participate in the state or the military again. But this kind of a compromise is not going to work, and it doesn't last. And finally, in around the year 400, Augustine, who was a bishop in Africa, came up with the just war theory. And the just war theory justified Christians, baptized Christians, in being in the military or the government and defending the empire so that chaos would be kept at bay. And then the last things I have on this timeline, the academy was a pagan school, kind of a university, that had originally been founded by Plato. So the academy was a Platonic, a place of Platonic teaching, pagan teaching. And it was finally closed in 529. That from that point on, pagans were not very public. They still weren't forced to become Christians, but they weren't very public. And also, the emperor at that time was Justinian, and he had a I have it right there. He had a Roman legal code. Organized. The Romans are known for their law. They did really good with their law. But it hadn't been codified or put into a uniform organization where you'd have topics, and so you'd have topics on the legal aspects of marriage and land ownership, etc. He had that codified or put together in an organized way. But at the very beginning, he has rules for the church. This is in Roman law. This is state law. Who can be a bishop? How a bishop is chosen? And things like that. So increasingly the church and state are coming together until finally we have the medieval world where they are very, very closely tied together. And it's time for me to quit. And maybe I'll, when I get up the next time, I'll say a few more things about church and state, the history of it. But then I want to really focus on scripture in the second session. So I will turn the time back to Jake, I think. Where is it? Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's James.